Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. We have two podcasts for you this week, Bereishit and Noach. This podcast is on Bereishit. We apologize for the delays in getting it to you. This podcast is by Rabbi Meir Schweiger. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. Parshat Bereishit begins a new cycle of Torah readings. Beginnings are very exciting. Beginnings are filled with hope. And our parsha, in the beginning, is no different. In chapter 1, we are told of a beautiful world which is created by God, done in a very systematic, orderly, developmental way. We are told how at each stage of the creation, God looks at what he created, and it is good. And at the very end of chapter 1, in verse 31, it says that God looked at all that he had done, and behold, it was very good. God creates a world which is very good, and the ultimate creation of that world, on day number 6, are human beings. Human beings created in the image of God. Human beings who are blessed by God to be fruitful and multiply, to fill the earth, to conquer it, to rule over all the creatures of the sea, of the heavens, and on the earth. To in effect become a partner with God in creation. To take that world which is very good and to bring it to another level. And yet, unfortunately, when we look at the end of the parsha, in chapter 6, verse 5, once again we see, and God looked, the same God who in the beginning of the parsha looks at all that he has created, and it is good. It is very good. At the end of the parsha, God looks at the evil of man, which has proliferated in the earth. God looks at how the inclinations of the thoughts of his heart are only evil all the day. In effect, what God sees is how this beautiful, good world which God has created has been transformed by people into a place of evil. How all the good has been inverted to be only evil. This is a process which happened over an extended period of time. How did it come about? Let's go back to chapter 1. God creates human beings in the image of God. Human beings are given the mandate to rule over the earth, to be partners with God in creation. Interestingly enough, in chapter 1, verse 28, the word that's used for ruling is Ridu, which means to go down, and that ideally the way that they should rule should be by going down to the level of those they rule, to be empathetic with them, what we would call today benign rule. And yet what seems to happen is that this role given to human beings of ruling becomes a desire or an expression of power and self-aggrandizement. In chapter 2, we are given a different version of the creation story, which it would seem is looking at the creation story from another angle, and another angle which is complementary to what we have in chapter 1. In chapter 2, people are not created in the image of God. Man is created from the dust of the earth. God breathes in him the breath of life. And that man which was created from the dust of the earth, this is chapter 2, verse 7, is subsequently taken by God, placed in the Garden of Eden, la'ovda u'lishomra, to serve it, to guard it. And subsequently, in verse 16, God commands that man to eat of all the trees of the garden, but from one tree, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, not to eat. If chapter 1 is describing the role given to man to be a ruler, to be a partner with God in creation, to develop that creation, to bring it to another level. In chapter 2, we are told of the role of man, which has to do with serving God, to accept the fact God is the king, we are the servants, God commands, we obey. And one might say that this model also becomes very instructive as to what does it mean to be a ruler. What does God command the Adam, the man? God commands the Adam to eat of all the trees of the garden except for one, which means that ultimately God is looking out for the best interests of the Adam, to be able to give him everything that he could possibly have that is for his own well-being. One tree God holds back, and that may also be for the well-being of that Adam, to understand his limitations, to understand his place, to know how to limit himself, in the same way that God has limited himself as well. And when we read the continuation of the story, that seems to be the crux of the problem. In chapter 3, we have described the first sin. In chapter 3, we have described the first sin of man. And the snake, in encouraging the woman to eat of the tree, says, "Why did God tell you not to eat from that tree?" Because God knows, this is chapter 3, verse 5, God knows that on the day that you eat from it, your eyes will be opened. You will become godlike, knowers of good and evil. And let me fast forward. The woman looks, and this is verse 6, the woman looks and she sees that the tree is good to eat. It is desirable to the eyes. And she takes from the fruit and eats it. Perhaps this is the first time where people see it is good. But it is good in contrast with what God sees as being good. God sees that it is good to not eat of that tree. The woman sees that it is good to eat from it, which means that she has already usurped the role of God. And why? Perhaps because of what appears afterwards. Ta'avahu le'inayim. It is desirable. Desire is what filters our understanding of, human understanding very often, of what is good and what is evil. What is good is that which fulfills my desire. Evil is when my desires go unfulfilled. To put it in different language, good is the expression of my self-gratification, my self-aggrandizement. Evil is when I'm not able to have that fulfillment. Let's look at the next example of sin. Cain and Abel. When Cain and Abel are born, ostensibly, this is a new beginning. And in fact, the woman articulates it when she says, "I have in chapter 4, verse 1, I have acquired a man with God." There is a feeling that perhaps now we can maybe correct something. This verse is actually very fascinating because it expresses a certain sense of empowerment of the woman, but an empowerment which is very much fulfilling her role as a woman to bring life into the world, to bring children into the world, and perhaps to be a partner with God in the further creation of the world. And yet all of a sudden, this new beginning goes awry. Cain is born, and Cain becomes a worker of the land, which is positive. He offers an offering to God, which is positive. But God doesn't accept his offering. God accepts the offering of his brother. And Cain's reaction is to be devastated. Let's think about this for a moment. When Cain brings the offering to God, what's the purpose of that offering? By the way, the offering is described as a mincha. Hirsch in his commentary says, Mincha is an expression of homage. It's an expression of recognition. God is the owner of the earth. God is the owner of everything which I have. I acknowledge that. And I now offer to God what is God's. And yet God doesn't seem to accept it. And Cain is devastated. And then the question is, but why? Is the offering really being presented to God? Or is the offering really about Cain? Is this really service of God? Or is this really self-service? And God engages Cain in a dialogue to try to steer him in the right direction. And we know the continuation of the story that Cain eventually kills his brother, Hevel. Murder becomes an act of empowerment. If we look at the way the verses describe it, Cain's face falls. He's very angry. He's devastated. He's rejected. He feels very, very low. He wants to regain his self-esteem, to regain his self-image. The way to do that is to show his power over his brother. The way to do that is to eliminate the competition, which therefore means that once again we have this desire towards empowerment, which is good in his eyes, but clearly evil in the eyes of God. Let us skip a little further. After God has a discussion with Cain, and God actually assures Cain that he will protect him and he will look after him and even gives him a sign. And the sign of Cain is actually a very, very positive element. This is what we find in chapter 4, verse 15. What is Cain's response? We are told in verse 16, and Cain goes out from before God. He settles in the land of Nod, east of Eden. And he knows his wife, and she becomes pregnant, and bears Chanoch, and he builds a city and calls it by the name of his son Chanoch. Going out from before God is an expression of going out from before the presence of God, going out from having any relationship with God. And in fact, what happens from that moment on is that Cain, in a very conscious way, breaks his relationship with God. When we read the continuation, which describes the line of Cain, God does not appear in anything which happens. In fact, he puts himself on a course, one might say, of obliterating any type of relationship with God, any type of consciousness of God. Rabbi Samson Farl Hirsch says that the first thing which Cain does is to build a city. Building a city is the polar opposite of being someone who works the land. Working the land gives people a heightened consciousness of God because it makes them very aware of their vulnerability. And especially as is mentioned in chapter 2 in Bereshit, to work the land, to get things to grow, you need rain. Rain is a gift of God, and therefore makes me aware of the fact that no matter what I do, I ultimately need God to bring it to fruition. But when I leave the land and I build a city, cities are expressions of empowerment of man. And perhaps the most significant expression of that is in next week's parsha, in the story of the Tower of Babel. Cities are what push man to achieve, to develop technology, to develop resources. They bring out the creativity of human beings to their fullest extent. In building a city, and perhaps I should also add, cities were also ways of protecting oneself. The classic example being walled cities. So that building a city becomes an attempt to empower himself, to perhaps reject the idea of being under God's protection and to now say, I will protect myself, I don't need God. Cain founds a line which culminates in Lamech, and the three sons of Lamech. One who is the founder of Yaval, the founder of Yoshev Ohel Umekneh. This is in chapter 4, verse 20. Yoshev Ohel Umekneh, commerce, business, And he has a brother whose name is Yuval. He is the father of all who grab the lyre and the harp, music, culture. And then there's a third son who is Tuval Kayin, Lotesh Kol Choresh Nechoshet Ubarzel, who forges metals and iron, copper, what we would call today technology. Which means that this line has, in effect, created the foundation for everything which we would call civilization. A civilization which is very much connected with human achievement. Civilization where God seems to be totally absent. A civilization which, I might add, is very much caught up with itself, with its empowerment. That's one line. But then we are told at the end of chapter 4 of another line which appears. After Cain kills Hevel, there is another son born whose name is Shet. And once again, his mother calls him by that name because God has given me another child. Once again, there is a sense of God in the world. And Shet has a son whose name is Enosh. And then it says, they began to call out in the name of God. And a number of commentaries say, what does it mean to call out in the name of God? Search for God. If we imagine that in the world of Cain, there is no God, all of a sudden there is a new alternative line, which is looking for God and trying to reclaim God. Interesting enough, it uses the word in chapter 4, verse 26, Az huchal, they began to call out in the name of God, huchal, a new beginning. Let us try to reclaim God. Rashi in his commentary brings a rabbinic understanding which says that the word huchal may be connected with the idea of desecration. In this process of searching for God, there is actually set in motion a desecration of God. And Maimonides, in the Mishneh Torah, when he talks about the laws of idolatry, in fact says the origins of idolatry began with this generation. And it was actually motivated by something very, very positive. People thought, how can we possibly serve a God who is invisible, relate to a God who is invisible? Well, perhaps the way to do that is to take those elements in our reality, which were created by God, and to worship them, but worship them in service of God. And as Maimonides notes, this was a mistake. It was an initiative that was taken, but an initiative which eventually degenerated and was manipulated by people of power, so that at some point along the line, what started out as an attempt to serve God ended up being self-service. And in the end, God disappeared from the equation. So as Maimonides describes, there came a point where people were worshiping these things in their own right, or worshiping sticks and stones as somehow an expression of worshiping forces of nature. Let me just note one last thing. In the beginning of chapter 6, we have another beginning. It says, when man began to proliferate on the face of the earth, and daughters were born, and the sons of God took the daughters, saw the daughters of man, that they were good, and took to them wives from all that they had chosen. A last beginning. People are beginning to increase, proliferate. One could say, are beginning to fulfill the divine directive or blessing in chapter 1. Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. The sons of God see the daughters of man that they are good. That takes us back to chapter 1 as well. God looks at the world, it is good. The sons of God look at the daughters of man that they are good. And there is a whole question, who are these sons of God and daughters of man? I want to take one explanation that appears in a number of commentaries that says that the sons of God, God means the judges. And Rashi comments that wherever there is a context of authority, we refer to it as God. God is associated with authority, which means that the sons of the people who have authority, the leaders, the judges, are now taking the daughters of man, which is understood to be the daughters of the common people. And one could say that this is a very positive development. This is what we would call a breakdown of social classes. We are all the same. There's no such thing as aristocracy in plebeians. On the other hand, this could also be seen as something which is very, very negative, which is the way it is understood in rabbinic literature. And that is that the sons of the people who not only have the authority, but now let's put it in different language, who have the power, now see the daughters of man who are good, and what does good mean, who are beautiful, maybe let's say another thing, who are good in their eyes, who they desire, and then they take them, not with their consent, but take anybody that they choose, who they so desire. Perhaps one of the best illustrations of this idea is what we actually find in the book of Esther. After King Ahasuerus has his queen removed, Queen Vashti, he becomes very, very upset that he no longer has a queen. So what does he do? He rounds up all the maidens in the land and basically has an initiation process by which he tries them all out to decide who will be his queen. They have no choice in the matter. They are being rounded up. And the person who's doing this is the person who has the power to then pick that woman who is good in his eyes. Or to put it in different terminology, to pick that woman who will gratify him, who will fulfill all his fantasies. What I've tried to show in the brief moments of our podcast are a series of examples of how people act upon what is good in their eyes. Good in their eyes, which is a code word for what empowers them, for what in the end makes them feel godlike. But in empowering them, it may be abusing what they are doing, what they are taking. And it is certainly perhaps in opposition to what God sees as being good. And therefore, if we had to summarize, we could say that perhaps what our parsha is trying to illustrate is the need for people to be able to find that balance between majesty and humility, between what is empowering to them and what is empowering to the world around them. What is empowering to them and what at the same time will bring to their awareness their being the servants of God, their need to bring the world into a relationship with God. And perhaps the tragedy of our parsha and the tragedy of human history is that all too often people focus on empowerment, self-gratification, and do not focus enough on humility and on the other, whether the other be God or the other be people or creation which surrounds us. So as we read Parshat Bereshit, let us focus on the fact that it is a beginning. It is a new cycle of readings. And that perhaps what the Torah is trying to show us is that there is always the possibility of having a new beginning, of having a different type of reality. And especially when we do this in the aftermath of Yom Kippur and Sukkot, we should try to say to ourselves, how can we now create a better reality? How can we now, we as human beings, create a world which is not only good in our eyes, but good in the eyes of God as well? Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Thanks for tuning in. And as I said, the next podcast will be with you shortly, and that's on Noach. Thanks for tuning in.